So, imagine a dead short circuit in an industrial factory. Just, for a fraction of a second, thousands of amps of raw power suddenly surge through the electrical system.
Right, which is a massive amount of energy.
Exactly. And I mean, you probably picture a blown fuse or a tripped breaker, maybe some sparks flying, right?
Yeah, that's what most people would visualize.
But you probably don't picture solid, 2-inch-thick copper bars violently bending like wet noodles, or like ripping heavy steel mounts straight out of a concrete wall.
No, definitely not.
Yeah.
But that is exactly what happens if the hidden arteries of our electrical infrastructure aren't engineered perfectly.
Yeah, and we are talking about bus bars today. So welcome to today's deep dive. It is Tuesday, May 19th, 2026, and we are taking a deep dive into this totally invisible, high-stakes world of industrial power distribution.
It's a fascinating topic.
It really is. Our mission today is we're taking a huge stack of international engineering standards, Schneider Electric design guides, and a bunch of metallurgical data, and we're decoding how engineers actually choose, size, and protect these massive metal conductors that literally keep the modern world running.
Yeah. Because it really is a high-stakes balancing act. I mean, selecting the right bus bar is not just some simple plumbing problem, you know? It's not like you just pick a pipe size and walk away.
Right, it's not just standard wiring.
Exactly. It's an incredibly complex intersection of physics, chemistry, and economics.
Yeah.
To understand how engineers do this, we really have to look past the normal wiring you might have in your walls at home.
Which is mostly what people are familiar with.
Yeah. But when you're dealing with hundreds or, thousands of amps inside giant gray electrical panels. The best material choice depends entirely on a cascade of physical realities. Critical thinking is absolutely essential here because, well, every single choice has a profound trade-off.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to even begin figuring out how to size one of these systems, we really have to start with the raw materials, right?
We do.
The heavyweights. And in one corner, we have the undisputed historical reigning champion, which is copper.
Yeah, copper. It is the default standard for a very good reason. Specifically, engineers usually rely on something called ETP copper.
Which stands for electrolytic tough pitch.
Exactly, electrolytic tough pitch or grade C11000 if you're looking at the specs. In practical panel design, this specific grade is the absolute go-to.
Because it hits that sweet spot.
Right. It perfectly balances raw conductivity, a reasonable cost, and the mechanical ability to actually bend and fabricate the metal without it snapping in half.
Right, because pure conductivity isn't the only metric you care about. Although, I mean, it is the baseline.
It is the baseline, yeah.
We measure everything against the International Annealed Copper Standard, or IACS, right? And copper sits right at that 100% baseline.
It does, which translates to roughly 58 mega Siemens per meter.
Mega Siemens, which just sounds like a massive amount of conductivity.
It is. And that incredible base conductivity means you can push a massive amount of electrical current through a relatively compact physical cross section.
Okay.
But, you know, as you hinted at, you can tweak that chemistry. Like, for instance, if you're designing a system for a high vacuum environment, you might specify oxygen-free copper.
Which is grade C10200, according to the data.
Right. Or, say, the bus bar is going to operate in extremely high temperatures where normal copper might actually begin to soften over time. Engineers will add trace amounts of silver to it.
Wait, really? Silver?
Yeah, silver-bearing copper. It actually locks the grain structure of the metal in place, providing, like, absolute thermal stability.
Oh, wow. Okay, so copper is this dense, highly conductive, tweakable baseline. But in the other corner, we have the challenger, which is aluminum.
Yes, aluminum.
And I always see aluminum presented as the great cost-saving alternative. But reading through the sources, it plays by a completely different set of physical rules, doesn't it?
Completely different. I mean, aluminum is a highly credible power rail material, but you have to engineer around its weaknesses.
Right.
The raw baseline is alloy 1350, but pure aluminum is actually quite soft. So engineers frequently pivot to alloy 6101 for bus bars.
To make it stiffer.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
What they're doing there is intentionally trading away a tiny bit of pure electrical conductivity to gain much-needed mechanical strength and machinability. You need the bar to, you know, hold its shape.
Makes sense.
And sometimes they even use alloy 6063 if the design requires really complex extruded shapes rather than just standard flat rectangular bars.
But here is the catch that I think always trips people up. The conductivity of these aluminum alloys is only about 61% of that IACS copper baseline.
Right, it's significantly lower.
So if I have a 1,000 amp load and I want to swap my copper bus bar for an aluminum one to save money, I can't just use the exact same size bar.
No, you definitely cannot.
I have to increase the physical cross-section of the aluminum by about 1.6 times just to carry the exact same current safely. It becomes physically much bulkier.
What's fascinating here is how this specific physical reality completely shifts the engineering decision. You might logically ask, you know, why would anyone want to design a switchboard using a metal that's nearly twice as bulky?
Yeah, why take up the space?
And the answer comes down to density. This is what we call the crucial weight flip.
Weight flip.
Yeah. Copper is incredibly dense, about 8.9 grams per cubic centimeter. Aluminum, by contrast, is remarkably light at just 2.7 grams per cubic centimeter.
So it's way lighter.
Way lighter.
So even though you have to use a physically larger piece of aluminum to hit your target ampacity, the sheer difference in density means the final bulkier aluminum bar actually weighs roughly half as much as the thinner copper bar.
Precisely. You're taking up more space, sure, but you are hanging significantly less dead weight on the structure of the building or the panel itself.
That's crazy. It makes me think of it like comparing vehicle engines, you know?
Okay, I like that.
Like copper is like a dense, high-performance sports car engine. It's heavy, it's ultra-compact, and it punches way above its physical size.
Right. But then aluminum is more like a bulky but incredibly lightweight delivery truck. I mean, they can ultimately deliver the exact same amount of payload or power in this case, but they command entirely different physical footprints in the real world.
That is a highly accurate way to visualize it. And that footprint constraint, that dictates the winner. Aluminum absolutely wins when overall weight and raw material costs are your primary concerns.
Like where?
Well, think about a massive long distribution run suspended from the ceiling of a huge automotive factory. Space isn't really a problem up there near the roof, but structural weight. Definitely.
Oh, right. You don't want tons of copper pulling down the ceiling.
Exactly. Aluminum is the rational choice there. But on the flip side, if you're designing a highly critical, incredibly dense, low-voltage switchboard to go inside a submarine,
right,
or into the basement of a Manhattan data center where every single square inch of real estate is profoundly expensive, copper absolutely dominates. You simply don't have the physical room for the bulky delivery truck, to use your analogy. Okay, but this brings up a massive question for me. If aluminum is half the weight and significantly cheaper by the kilogram, why isn't it just the default everywhere? Like, why do we still mine and use so much expensive copper?
Because a bus bar system is almost never just one continuous unbroken loop of metal.
Okay.
Eventually, it has to connect to a breaker, to a cable, or to another bus bar. It has joints. And the chemistry and mechanical realities of those joints are the weakest link in the entire chain.
Interesting.
This is where aluminum's flaws become glaringly obvious.
Well, let's get into those flaws, because I always assumed aluminum was great for corrosion resistance. I mean, soda cans don't rust out in the rain like iron does. Why is that a liability here?
It is exactly because of how it prevents rust that it causes electrical problems.
Wait, what?
Yeah. As soon as bare aluminum is exposed to the oxygen in the air, it almost instantaneously forms a tough, microscopic layer of aluminum oxide on its surface. That oxide layer is what stops the rest of the metal from corroding. But in electrical engineering, aluminum oxide is a phenomenal insulator. It actively blocks the flow of electricity.
Oh, I see. So if you just bolt two bare aluminum bars together without scraping off that invisible oxide layer, the electricity has a really hard time crossing the gap.
Exactly. The electrical resistance at that joint spikes. And, well, fundamental physics tells us that high electrical resistance generates heat.
Right, a lot of heat.
And the problem compounds, because aluminum has a very high coefficient of thermal expansion, much higher than copper. It expands significantly as it heats up and shrinks as it cools down.
And as it expands and shrinks underneath the tight pressure of a steel bolt, it suffers from cold flow, right? I saw that term in the data.
Yes, creep or cold flow. Mm. It's a mechanical property where the metal actually yields and deforms under sustained pressure.
Because it's softer.
Exactly. If you bolt two aluminum bars together tightly, the thermal cycling combined with the pressure of the bolt causes the aluminum lattice to literally slip and deform. So over time, the joint mechanically relaxes. It loosens itself. And a loose joint creates more resistance, which creates more heat, which causes more expansion, which loosens the joint even further.
That sounds like a disaster.
It is a runaway thermal reaction that often ends in a melted panel.
And it gets even worse if you try to connect that aluminum directly to copper, right? Like, if an engineer tries to mix the two metals, they run straight into galvanic corrosion.
It is a chemical nightmare. If you have direct copper to aluminum contact, and there is even a trace of moisture in the air, you have accidentally built a crude battery.
A battery.
Yeah. The moisture acts as an electrolyte, allowing electrons to flow between the dissimilar metals. The galvanic reaction literally causes the less noble metal, which is the aluminum, to rapidly pit, degrade, and just be eaten away.
Man. So to safely use aluminum, you have to engineer away all of these chemical liabilities.
Every single one of them.
You have to meticulously plate the surfaces. You have to use specialized bimetallic transition hardware so the copper and aluminum never actually touch. You have to coat the joints in those messy antioxidant joint compounds. And you have to train technicians to use incredibly disciplined torque wrench practices so they don't over-tighten and accelerate that cold flow you mentioned.
Surface chemistry and maintenance become absolutely everything. Bare copper is wonderfully forgiving. You know, you can bolt it together in a clean indoor environment and it will perform beautifully for decades.
Yeah, copper just works.
Right. I mean, sure, we often plate copper, like pin plating to aid solderability, or silver plating for high temperature zones, because silver oxide actually remains highly conductive.
Oh, that's smart.
Or nickel plating for highly polluted environments.
Mm-hmm.
But aluminum absolutely relies on these surface platings just to survive basic everyday industrial conditions.
Which makes me question the entire premise of aluminum being the economic champion here.
How so?
Well, if I am the purchasing manager and I save a bunch of money up front on the raw bulk aluminum, but then I have to pay to have it all tin plated and I have to buy specialized bimetallic hardware, source antioxidant pastes, and then pay highly skilled maintenance technicians to constantly inspect and retorque those joints every single year. Are you actually saving any money in the end?
You have hit on the exact trap that catches inexperienced engineers. The kilogram price of the raw material is an illusion.
Really?
Yeah. When you zoom out and calculate the total life cycle cost, the installation labor, the specialized hardware, the thermal risk, and the ongoing maintenance footprint, the true economic advantage often shifts firmly back to copper for anything highly critical or tightly packaged.
That makes total sense.
You really only save real money with aluminum on those massive long-distance runs where the sheer volume of bulk material savings finally outweighs the expensive jainting penalties.
Okay, so let's say you've navigated that minefield. You've weighed the life cycle costs, the footprint, and the chemistry, and you finally picked your metal.
Okay, step one is done.
The next step is figuring out the actual dimensions, right? How big does this bar need to be to carry our theoretical 1,000 amps? But looking through these engineering guides, it seems like the published capacity tables everyone relies on are practically works of fiction.
I wouldn't call them fiction, but they are absolutely a theoretical best-case scenario.
Okay.
They represent a free air estimate. Imagine a copper bar suspended in an infinitely large, perfectly climate-controlled room.
Which doesn't exist in a factory.
Exactly. That is not reality. The real engineering work is what we call the dark art of sizing and derating. It involves a very deliberate 6-step workflow.
Okay, walk me through it.
First, you establish your continuous current. Second, you pick a trial cross-section from those optimistic tables. Third, you apply derating multipliers. Fourth, you calculate the actual temperature rise based on your specific enclosure. Fifth, you verify the short circuit fault duty. And finally, you confirm the mechanical supports.
I really want to dig into step three, those derating multipliers, because this completely changes the math.
It does.
You look at a stock size table, say, a 100 millimeter by 10 millimeter flat copper bar. The table promises you about 1,600 amps of capacity. But the reality is, you are never going to hang that bar in the open air. You're going to shove it inside a sealed gray metal box.
Exactly. And that enclosure instantly alters the thermodynamic reality of the system. The metal box traps heat.
Right.
Because the heat cannot escape into the surrounding room, the ambient temperature inside the box begins to rise. To prevent the buzz bar from exceeding its maximum safe operating temperature, you have to push less current through it.
So you have to handicap it.
Yes. Just placing the bar inside in a closed panel immediately forces you to hit that 1600 amp rating with a 0.80 to 0.90 multiplier. You lose 10 to 20% of your theoretical capacity before you even flip a switch.
Wow. It makes total sense, though. It's like looking at your personal best marathon time, which you set on a crisp, cool spring morning, but then trying to run that exact same marathon pace inside a hot sauna while wearing a winter coat. You obviously can't perform at your maximum capacity because your body cannot shed the heat. You have to slow down, you have to derate your pace, or you will literally overheat and collapse.
That is precisely what is happening to the electrons in the metal lattice. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this is why international standards, particularly IEC 61439, demand rigorous, physically verified temperature rise limits inside the final closed assembly.
The standard enforces it.
Yes. The enclosure dictates the physics. The standard specifically caps the temperature rise of terminals connecting to external insulated cables at a strict 70 Kelvin limit.
70 Kelvin?
Yeah. If you don't derate the bus bar properly, that heat migrates down the metal, reaches the terminal, and literally melts the plastic insulation right off the incoming cables.
And it isn't just the fact that it's in a box. I read that the physical orientation of the metal bar inside that box changes its capacity.
It does.
Like, if you mount a flat rectangular bus bar horizontally, like a tabletop, it actually has worse cooling performance. You get hit with another 0.95 derating multiplier compared to mounting that exact same bar vertically on its edge. Why does turning it 90 degrees matter so much?
It comes down to fluid dynamics and convection. As the bus bar heats up, it heats the air immediately surrounding it.
Okay.
Hot air is more buoyant, so it rises. If the wide, flat surface of the bar is mounted vertically on its edge, that rising hot air naturally flows up and across the massive surface area, constantly drawing cooler air in from the bottom.
Oh, like a chimney.
Exactly. It creates its own highly efficient convection current. But if you mount it flat like a table, the hot air just gets trapped underneath it, and the cooling efficiency plummets.
And if you need to carry massive loads, you can't just use one giant piece of metal, right? You put multiple bars right next to each other for the same phase.
That's parallel bars.
But they radiate heat into each other. So if you stack three bars side by side, your capacity multiplier drops all the way down to about 0.80 because the middle bar is essentially sandwiched in a thermal oven.
The thermal management calculations are incredibly complex. But, you know, as difficult as managing that steady state heat is, it is really only half the battle. Yeah, because derating handles everyday normal operations. But engineers don't just design for a typical Tuesday afternoon. They have to design for the absolute worst case scenario.
Right.
What happens when the system fails catastrophically? We have to shift our focus away from gradual thermal challenges and confront shocking mechanical forces.
Right. Which brings us to step five in the workflow, verifying fault duty. We are talking about surviving a short circuit. And earlier I mentioned the idea of heavy copper bars bending. This completely blew my mind when I read it. Surviving a short circuit often forces an engineer to make the bus bar massive, like far larger than what is required for the everyday normal load current.
Absolutely. During a dead short circuit, a massive, near instantaneous spike of fault current rushes through the system in the milliseconds. Before the mechanical breakers even have time to physically trip and clear the fault.
Just milliseconds. Mm-hmm.
And the system has to survive two completely different phenomena during that tiny window.
Okay.
First is thermal withstand. The copper or aluminum must have enough raw physical mass to absorb an unbelievable spike of heat energy, like a giant heat sink, without melting the metal or vaporizing the nearby insulation.
But it is the second phenomenon, the mechanical withstand, that is truly stunning. Are we actually saying that the electricity itself creates enough physical electromagnetic force to tear steel and bend copper?
Yes. It is one of the most violent and incredible aspects of power engineering.
That's insane.
When you have tens of thousands of amps surging through parallel bus bars during a fault, they generate immense competing magnetic fields. It is a physical manifestation of the Lorentz force.
The Lorentz force.
Right. If the fault current in two parallel bars is flowing in opposite directions, those magnetic fields violently repel each other. If the current is flowing in the same direction, they violently attract each other. We are talking about instantaneous mechanical forces equivalent to multiple tons of physical impact occurring in a fraction of a second.
So we aren't just designing for heat dissipation. We are essentially designing a mechanical fortress to hold these bars in place.
Precisely. And this is why specific standards like IEC 608651 are so critical. That standard provides the highly complex mathematical formulas required to calculate the exact peak conductive force generated during that magnetic explosion.
Wow.
You'd have a beautifully calculated copper bus bar, perfectly derated, to comfortably carry the thermal heat of a 1,000 amp everyday load. But if the insulated support brackets holding that bar aren't spaced closely enough together, or if they lack the required tensile stiffness, a short circuit will physically rip that copper bar out of its mountings. The magnetic propulsion will bend it, smash it into the steel enclosure, and completely destroy the panel before the breaker even opens.
Okay, you just mentioned IEC 608651, and that perfectly transitions us into the final and perhaps most dizzying part of all this, which is the alphabet soup of international engineering standards.
Oh, yes. The standards.
Because the stakes are so high, ranging from slow, creeping thermal meltdowns to instantaneous electromagnetic explosions, the entire industry relies on strict rule books. But there isn't just one book.
No, it's a highly fragmented landscape. But each standard serves a highly distinct purpose. You can think of IEC 61439-1 as the overarching umbrella framework.
Okay, the umbrella.
It dictates the rules for the entire low-voltage switchgear assembly. It defines the environmental service conditions and sets the testing procedures for how you verify that the assembled box as a whole is safe.
Right, and then you have IEC 608651, which handles the math for those violent thermal and mechanical short circuit forces we just talked about.
Exactly.
But if you want to know about the actual physical metal itself, like the purity of the copper before it even becomes a bus bar, you have to look elsewhere. You go to BSEN 13601 in Europe or ASTM B187 in the US to define the exact chemical purity, tensile strength, and dimensions of the raw stock.
Right. And if you are an engineer working in North America designing dead front switchboards or metal enclosed gear, your primary rule books are going to be IEC 37.1.1 and NEMA PB2.
There is also a highly specific warning for engineers and buyers regarding a legacy trap in the data.
Oh, yes.
Do not fall for DIN 46433. It is an old, outdated German standard for flat rectangular copper bar dimensions. Apparently, a lot of legacy component catalogs still actively cite it, but it has been officially withdrawn. For modern European work, you need to be referencing EN 13601.
It is easy to see how a designer could get completely lost in this alphabet soup, honestly.
Oh.
But this raises an important question. How do you navigate it? Well, the secret is remembering one golden rule. You can never, ever separate the material standard from the assembly verification standard.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, buying an incredibly pure ASTM-certified piece of copper means absolutely nothing if you don't install it, support it, derate it, and verify it according to the strict thermal and mechanical rules of IEC 61439.
Ah, I see.
The safety doesn't live in the metal alone. The safety lives in the combination of the material and the verified assembly.
So what does this all mean for you? We have journeyed from the microscopic galvanic chemistry of an oxidized aluminum joint all the way to the raw brute force physics of a magnetic short circuit.
We really have covered a lot of ground.
We've seen that sizing a bus bar is the ultimate exercise in system-level thinking. Every single decision is a profound balancing act. Engineers are constantly juggling physical space constraints, the sheer weight of the metal, the unforgiving chemistry of the connections, the harsh thermal realities of trapped heat, and the terrifying mechanical forces of a fault.
It's incredible.
So the next time you walk past an industrial electrical room or see one of those giant gray metal boxes humming quietly outside a factory or an office building, don't just think of it as a boring box of wires. Think about the hidden, highly engineered, massive metal arteries inside those bus bars, performing a delicate, high-stakes physical balancing act every single second of the day just to keep the lights on.
It is a delicate balance indeed. And it leaves me with one final provocative thought to ponder as we look ahead.
Oh, let's hear it.
Our discussion today gives us the established rules for the present moment, but we are rapidly transitioning into a completely unprecedented era of extreme power consumption.
Like AI and stuff.
Exactly. Think about the rise of hyperscale data centers built specifically for artificial intelligence processing. Or think about megawatt-level electric vehicle charging stations popping up on highway corridors.
Yeah, that draws a ton of power.
The sheer power densities required for these new technologies are skyrocketing, while the physical footprints we want to put them in are continually shrinking. Will these incredible new demands push traditional solid copper and aluminum bus bars to their absolute physical and thermal limits? Will the staggering density of tomorrow's power requirements eventually force the world to invent an entirely new kind of highly conductive material or fundamentally rewrite the safety standards we rely on today?
Man, that is a fascinating question. If the physics remain the same but the demands double, something has to give.
Something will definitely have to give.
But for now, we will leave you to think on that. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive, and keep questioning the physical world around you. We'll catch you on the next one.